Blog Talk Radio.
Performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I am very pleased to have as my guest music journalist Joe Daly. How are you, Joe?
I'm doing great, Rich. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. This is a real honor.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Joe Daly contributes regularly to magazines such as Metal Hammer, Classic Rock, Bass Guitar Magazine, and Outburn. He is the music editor for The Weaklings, and he is the music and culture commentator for Fight Club author Chuck Palahniuk's Lit Reactor. Joe has been writing about heavy metal and other music for over 20 years, and his pieces on Slayer / Guns N' Roses and others have earned him awards, acclaim, and quite a few snarky comments on Facebook. When he's not drafting wild-eyed manifestos, Joe enjoys life in San Diego's groovy North County, doing yoga, running, playing guitar, and spending tireless hours in deep and meaningful conversations with his beloved dogs, Cabo and Lola. Originally from Boston, which I believe is where he is now, Joe is a 13-year vegetarian and animal rights advocate. His first album was Elton John's Greatest Hits, and his first concert was Aerosmith on their 1984 Back in the Saddle tour. Joe, I actually would like to start out by talking about that Elton John record and Aerosmith concert, because one of the things that I'm curious about are what kinds of impressions did those two musical experiences make upon you, and how would you say they laid the groundwork for your future musical journey?
Well, it's growing up, my parents were older, and the only records we had in the house were really old-timey, thick wool sweater Irish music, and that's cool until about age 4, and then you see your friends wearing cool clothes and no one's talking about that stuff. And one of those friends showed me an Elton John record. And, that was, I hate to sound dated, but that was in the days of vinyl. And so that first experience was just as important visually as it was sonically.
Also just in a very tactile way, too, because I just love the feel of those records.
Oh, I mean, everything. It's just, as a kid, kind of entering modern music through that artist and that album, it was only later that I saw that I entered at such a high point of, a high entry point, that was polished, the songwriting was amazing, and you're looking at this eye-popping record jacket with these guys wearing, denim, studded with diamonds and huge glasses, and it was like, wow, these guys have long hair, and they're cool, and I want more of this.
Right. And then, what was it like to go from that and then to actually, see a band like Aerosmith in concert? What kind of impression did that make upon you?
It was nuts. I mean, I had between Elton John and Aerosmith, I found the local classic rock station here in Boston, WAAF. I grew up in Worcester and Central Mass, and it was just Led Zeppelin, Stones, Aerosmith, Blue Oyster Cult all day long. And I was at a flea market on Cape Cod one day, and I saw Aerosmith's Greatest Hits. And I don't know, I was going to pay $6 for it. And my mother had no idea what was going on, but she went over and she's like, "No way, you're not paying $6 for that album." She's like, "I can get it for $2. And she just totally beat this poor guy down to $3 for a vinyl of Aerosmith's Greatest Hits. And, you know, I memorized every note on that album. And then in 1984, they got back together and they played here in Worcester, and man, that was all she wrote.
Right. You know, you vividly remember your first record, you remember this concert. You know, my first concert was Rush, with of all things, Blondie opening for Rush at the Philadelphia
Whoa.
Spectrum. Yeah, I really had to give it to Blondie. There were like two Blondie fans, these poor girls up front, you know, in like safety pinned clothing amidst the sea of guys, you know, smelling, you know, denim reeking of pot and, you know, just waiting for Rush to come on stage. But, you know, you remembered your show. I remember that show. You know, I remember music. I remember, you know, this first time I kissed a girl at a summer camp, and I very vividly remember, you know, it was like, you know, one of the first times I'd ever like French kissed a girl, and there was that song Rock the Boat playing, and you know, you could ask someone what was the first song, you know, what was, you know, when you first had sex, what song was playing or what were you listening to, and you know, people have so many memories connected to music. And I'm curious, you know, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, you know, thinking about our conversation coming up, and what do you think about that? Why do you think music is so attached to memories in our lives, and we can go back and, you know, while some things might be fuzzy, we can pinpoint a song, and because we can pinpoint that song, we can also pinpoint the memory.
You know, that's such a great question. You know, it's music is something that it's portable, right? It's like once it's encoded in your psyche, you know, something resonates with you. And a lot of times, you know, everyone's had this experience. You kind of forget about it. Like, you know, this is crazy. I in 1978, my dad bought me Kiss Double Platinum. And,
nice.
It was, you know, fantastic, right? And I just could not get enough of it. And then, Pink Floyd released The Wall, and I forget about Kiss for the next 35 years. And I went out and I saw them live on the night of my 44th birthday. I went up alone. Someone gave me a ticket at the last minute, and I just fell in love with Kiss all over again. And I bought that album the next day, and I had this amazing epiphany where I was listening to it, and all of a sudden it just like a cascade of memories came, and I realized that these little melodies and these little snippets that I've carried in the back of my head and hummed and whistled and, you know, whatever, they all came from that album. And they've
wow.
just been sitting there in the back of my mind for years. And I'm, you know, ragging on Kiss, trying to sound cool. And meanwhile, like the most memorable snippets, you know, of my formative years, they gave to me. So there's something about music. It's just wherever you go, those impulses are with you. It's not like taste and it's not like sight. It's something totally different.
Yeah, you know, just sort of lingering on this thought for a moment more, you know, like I said, I've been really trying to think about it, you know, and when you think of other forms of art, literature, you know, painting, whatever, you know, a lot of those exist in the mind. You know, books are very much sort of an art for the mind, painting to some degree too, and music is of the mind, but it's really also of the body, because you know, we dance to music, we move to music, it gets into our guts, and I was trying to think, you know, is this part of the reason that, you know, music, you know, we remember music so well, because it's not only of the mind, but it's also of the body.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's that primal aspect of music, you know, and that's why, like, the most memorable pieces of music, you know, are those visceral ones, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, old, you know, Beethoven, or whether you're talking about Led Zeppelin. There's stuff that kind of pulls you physically in some kind of direction, or it makes you stop. It has a physical dimension to it.
Right.
You know, no one's go ahead.
What's that?
Sorry.
No,
I was
going
to say, you know, no one's shaking their hips to the Lemon Sisters, you know, walking around the supermarket these days. But Zeppelin, people
right.
still stop and move.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, as you well know, there's so many different types of music, folk, metal, country, industrial, you know, rock, classic rock, pop rock, as Jack Black so humorously referred to it in High Fidelity, sad bastard music. I mean, the list goes on and on. And, you know, different people gravitate towards different types of music. You know, and in a way, this might be an obvious question, but I'd love to hear your take on this. What do you think people are trying to work out within themselves when they listen to certain artists or certain types of music?
I think that's a great question, and it's, you know, it's obviously personal to everybody, but I think generally, you know, I think music kind of like opens a valve. You got something pent up, you know, and whether it's you've got a lot of joy and you want to listen to Katrina and the Waves and bop around the room like a crazy person, or you've got rage, you know, and you want to put on Metallica. You know, I think what music somehow it accesses some kind of emotional valve that releases things very quickly and very profoundly. And, you know, it's I don't know. I guess, you know, music can certainly change your mood, but I see music more as a way to quicken and deepen, you know, a state of mind.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You know, there have been many examples throughout history where music has had a significant impact on affecting various trends and cultures. What are some of the most significant moments to you, you know, thinking about music and how it's affected trends and culture, and why do you think that music is perhaps able to make these sort of changes in ways that other art forms might not be able to?
I mean, to me, music's, you know, the biggest moments, the watershed moments of music are those where some artist in some way has, you know, extended a giant middle finger at some convention, you know, whether it's Elvis shaking his hips or Jim Morrison, you know, saying, you know, the word hi on TV, later exposing himself, you know,
right.
You know, singing about things that used to be taboo. I mean, I think that those are the moments where when music pushes something and doesn't get pushed back, rap, hip hop, I mean, what a revolution those guys have started.
Right.
You know, that to me is, you know, when they make a change that is not reversed, those are the big moments of music.
Right. Well, you mentioned rap just now, and I know you did an interview with Chuck D from Public Enemy. And
yeah.
In fact, I think you interviewed him while you were jet lagged in a London hotel room and he was driving through the desert toward L.A. Can you talk about that experience, what Public Enemy has meant to you and perhaps some of the things you learned from interviewing him?
Yeah, you know, it was a funny scene. I had landed in London. I was going to the Download Festival and then the Metal Hammer Awards, which are kind of like the heavy metal Grammys. And I just got into London. I checked into my room, and I opened up my email, and this publicist had emailed me and said, hey, Chuck's going to be in the car. Like, apropos of nothing, Chuck's going to be in the car for a few hours if you want to interview him. So I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, I was wide awake. So, yeah, I emailed back. I said, yeah, where should I call him? And she gave me his number, and we just talked, and it was surreal because I was in this London hotel room staring out at the lights of the city. And I knew that he was driving through the desert, and we just talked about Elvis and rock and roll, and we were talking about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's, you know, he's one of the most articulate, you know, intelligent, insightful guys I've ever spoke to about, you know, music and art, and he just keeps pushing it. So it was a cool privilege, and
right.
You know, for me, it's just like, you know, hip hop is, they're like the Sex Pistols, man. The Public Enemy and the Sex Pistols, they're same, you know, the same value to modern music. You know, they both kind of took something and said, we don't like it, we're going to do what we want, and they just happened to do it really well.
Right. In that Chuck D interview, I seem to recall him saying something about, you're talking about the music business and things like that, and he said something along the lines of, He doesn't hate the business, but he hates the game. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about that.
You know, I mean, I think that Chuck has always kind of respected, you know, someone's right to commercialize their efforts. You know, he's not that kind of hater where he says, you know, you can't or can't do that. That's selling out. But to that extent, I mean, I think that, you know, he's been around long enough to know that there's a lot of, inauthenticity, I guess.
Right.
You know, where he doesn't – what I interpreted his point of view to be is that, you know, true talent is not recognized. True talent is recognized, imitated, broken down, you know, and repackaged in a safe and unthreatening way. And, you know, it's I don't think he sees that the real talent is making it out and can make it out.
Wow. So you've interviewed the likes of Moby, as we, you know, been talking about Chuck D slash, you know, musicians that I truly appreciate for many reasons. How do you get hooked up with these interviews?
You know, if it's for one of the magazines, then they'll call me and they'll say, you know, it's great. Like Metal Hammer is the best, right? You'll wake up one morning because they're 8 hours ahead of me in San Diego, and you'll get an email that just the subject line will just say Metallica.
Nice.
You know, or Black Sabbath. And it'll be, you know, from one of the editors. And you don't even have to open that email to know that something amazing awaits you in a very immediate window of time. Some of them, like, you know, if an artist is doing something, I'm not ashamed to admit that, you know, because I have these platforms, I'll reach out to artists who I admire and just say, hey, you know, I see you got a new album out. I'd love to interview you for this magazine or for the Weaklings or, you know, whatever. And I'm really lucky to have that access.
Yeah, well, it's great leverage to be able to, you know, to go to those people and say, well, you know, here's my resume as far as people I've spoken to before. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be foolish to turn that down. Have you ever been starstruck by any interview on any level?
You know, I'd love to lie and say no. I'm all business. But no, I have been starstruck before. I'll say that, you know, I spent a day in the studio with Slash last January, and I don't know if I was starstruck, but I sure as hell was nervous.
Right.
And, you know, because that's a long window of time, and I knew we had a lot of stuff to cover, and we already talked on the phone a couple of times, and it could not have been easier or cooler. And the trippiest moment was we were in the studio, his recording studio in Hollywood. Like, you could drive by it 20 times and not know it's this epic, you know, really nice studio where inside Slash and his band are polishing off this amazing album.
Wow.
And we finished the main part of our interview, and he said, hey, you want to go downstairs and listen to the album? I was like, yeah, you know, absolutely. So he goes, I'll go get the producer, who's Eric Valentine, who's just an amazing producer. He said, I'll get Eric to go turn it on for you. So he disappears, and I'm cleaning my stuff up in his lounge upstairs in his recording studio, and then I just hear him say, hey, Joe, hey, you ready? Come on down. And I stopped. It was this vivid moment where I was just like, holy crap, someone is calling me from downstairs, and it's Slash. You know, it was just like I was totally kind of like I stopped in my tracks and was like, whoa.
Nice. Now, if I'm correct, I think you have Slash's Les Paul tattooed on your back, but your tattoo artist fucked it up. Is that correct?
So this is really, really embarrassing because it's even more embarrassing than that, right?
Because I have a tattoo on my back.
Yeah, and I, you know, and it's his Les Paul custom sunburst, and it's on fire. Because I was going to get a Celtic Cross covering up one that I had on there. And then I said, you know, I think I want to. And it was this biker tattoo. And he said, what? And I was like, nah, nothing. He goes, no, come on, what? And I said, I always thought it would be kind of cool to get a guitar on fire. And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, yeah, man, I hate meaningful tattoos. Let's do it. And so after he did it for the next 7 years, I've been noticing, it was like, it's a lefty. He did it backwards. And so here's the, which has embarrassed me to no end, but the cap actually happened on Wednesday. I was surfing with Johnny Colt, the bass player of Lynyrd Skynyrd, and cool. And he was in the Black Crowes for 10 years, and he goes, look at that tattoo. I was like, yeah, look at how they messed it up. He goes, what do you mean? And I said, look, how it's a lefty. I'm like, how embarrassing is that? He goes, that's not a lefty, dude. I'm like, no, that's a lefty. He goes, no, that's a perfectly good right-handed Les Paul. He goes, oh. You've been looking at that in the mirror.
Oh!
So, nice. Yeah, I can't catch a break on that tattoo.
That's funny. So one of your favorite bands is a band, Anathema, I believe, correct?
Yeah.
Now, I was wondering, because we're going to play a little piece of a track from them, from Internal Landscapes. I was wondering if you
cool.
could talk a little about the band, what they mean to you, and also if you could, talk about this particular, tell the story about Joe Garaci and his story, and, because it's part of this track that we're going to listen to.
It's amazing. This is probably my favorite album of last year. And Anathema was this, they were the in the early 90s, they started this movement, or they were one of the early bands in the UK to start doom metal. Super heavy. You know, if you're not a metalhead, it's unlistenable music. It's just ponderous. It's like, it's depressing. It's doomy. And they've had this evolution, the past 3 decades, where now, like, their album is just, their music is bright and it's ambient and it's textured and atmospheric. It's beautiful. It's like two different bands, but it's been a very organic and really interesting, arc. And as a result, like, no one would ever accuse them of selling out, because what they're doing is, like, it's so ambitious. And
right.
this new album that, Weather Systems, it came out last year, it's about loss, loss of either death or of a relationship, and it begins with the loss of just this gut-wrenching loss, and just dealing with acceptance, and the whole, trying to figure it out. The whole album moves towards this last song that you're referring to.
Yeah.
And it's, the question coming up to that song is like, loss sucks. It's brutal. How can we deal with it? And the way they end it is the most brilliant, it's the most brilliant turn I think I've heard in a long time. And it just, the song starts out with Joe Garaci telling the story. He was in Connecticut back in the 80s, and he had this condition, and, long story short, he was rushed to the hospital, and he died in the waiting room with his wife by his side. And he was brought back to life, but in this time where he was clinically dead, he had this crazy near-death experience, and it was okay, and that's what the, and it begins with him telling this story, this old clip that they found of him. And it's masterful, because how do you deal with death? How can you accept death? Well, what if, you had this guy who's been there saying, hey, it's not, everything's going to be okay. And it's just beautiful.
In fact, I want to read from the piece that you wrote. You say, Garaci describes what happened on the other side. He experienced timelessness, love, and a tremendous ease of letting go. Garaci saw his life on Earth as a brief instant, and death as an infinite beauty, and love as the bridge between the two. It's truly beautiful. Why don't we go ahead and listen from Weather Systems. This is Anathema and a segment from their track Internal Landscapes.
And I felt myself going. I was in a great deal of pain. It was a very frightening experience. But I began to slip. I just sort of feel myself going. And I remember trying to hold on. I'll be okay. And it got to the point where I just couldn't. And everything began to just become very quiet. And I can remember with every ounce of strength I had, I wanted to say goodbye to my wife. It was important to me. And I did. I remember just turning my head and looking at her and saying, I'm going to die. Goodbye, Joan. And I did. It was then that I experienced what we call a near-death experience. For me, there was nothing near about it. It was there. It was a total immersion in light, brightness, warmth, peace, security. I did not have an out-of-body experience. I did not see my body or anyone about me. I just immediately went into this beautiful, bright light. It's difficult to describe. Matter of fact, it's impossible to describe. Verbally, it cannot be expressed. It's something which becomes you, and you become it. I could say that I was peace. I was love. I was the brightness. It was part of me.
From Anathema's weather systems, that was Internal Landscapes, or at least an excerpt from Internal Landscapes. Now, Joe, is the singer Daniel Kavanagh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the piece you had written and you had referred to the band as doom metal, music heavy enough to smash a black hole, because I had never heard them before, and then I got this track off of iTunes, I was like, oh my God, he's got this beautiful, strong, soaring, tenor-like voice. And I mean, he's really a beautiful voice.
It's amazing. And the funny thing is, if you go back and you listen to their old stuff, it's you know, it sounds ghoulish. I mean, that's what doom metal is, you know,
right.
But so it's not inappropriate for that. But yeah, his voice is just, and Lee Douglas, the woman singing on that, I mean, they're just, it's a great, They're a great combination. And they're on tour right now.
Oh, good for them. Good, good. You know, somewhere around 1999, a little company called Napster came along and basically turned the music industry on its head. And, you know, frankly, I don't know. I don't know if it's ever fully recovered from that experience. What are your thoughts on how the industry was affected by Napster and that whole thing and how it's changed over the years to deal with that shakeup? And where do you think the industry is heading?
You know, it was the perfect storm. You know, and everybody is kind of, there's a lot of myths in music. One of them is that grunge killed hair metal. That's not true. And the other is that, you know, Napster kind of destroyed the music industry. And that's not true. But Napster, I think, was the catalyst. And it was only half of the equation, though. I think that Napster, you know, could not have succeeded if it weren't for broadband cable, you know, hitting everybody's household. So it was this perfect storm of everyone getting broadband cable cheaply to their house, and this file sharing service coming in. And yeah, I mean, now all of a sudden, people don't have to pay $17 to go across town to get a CD, you know? So yeah, that did change everything. And, you know, there's that famous graph of the music industry after Napster. That era saw the, you know, the, I guess the breaking down of the old architecture. But the music industry, look, people still, iTunes has sold over a billion songs. Music's alive and well. It's just that the people holding on to the old way of making money, you know, they're carping and complaining. And, you know, I guess if their livelihood's tied to it, I can see that. But it's still very vibrant. You just have to look a little harder.
Right. Where do you think all of this leads the artists in this day and age?
Well, it's funny because the artist isn't going to make money off of, you know, their album sales, right? I mean, some will, but most won't. You know, albums are like calling cards now. You give them away for free. You give away downloads. You know, the artist has to do something remarkable. You know, and I don't. When I say remarkable, I don't mean sensational. I mean something that, you know, kind of shakes people out of what they're listening to and says, oh, these guys are different. And, you know, you and I could each go into our bedrooms tonight and pop out GarageBand and release an album, right? Anyone can release an album. So I think the bar has gotten higher.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, speaking of Napster and everything, in the year 1999, during that year, one of the most influential records, and one, for that matter, one of the most influential artists, came into play. I'm referring to Moby and his release Play. And it's funny because at the time, you know, his was an electronic music odyssey that was sort of released in a time where there was a lot of other stuff going on. Why do you think his release made such an impact at that time? And also, you interviewed Moby not long ago, and if you could talk about that interview as well.
Yeah, you know, that hit because it was good. It was really good. It was, you know, that was a fearless piece of music. And when I say fearless, you know, for him, like, he had thought he missed the boat. You know, all the other kind of electronic disco type acts had passed him. You know, he was in his 30s. And, you know, so he just kind of, he wrote that. That was an album that he wrote with no expectation. He wasn't writing it for anyone. He just kind of said, here are some cool things that I like for me. And that shows, you know, his reward is that all 18 tracks got licensed. It sold millions of copies, you know, and it succeeded because it's just full of hooks. And, you know, he's an amazing melodic composer. And it's just, you know, it's a very cool, you know, there's a lot of mood and a lot of emotion in that, despite the fact that it comes out of electronics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking along those lines, to you, what are some examples of musicians, artists that have successfully been able to branch out into different directions and do a lot of different things over the course of their career?
You know, I think about a guy like Kid Rock, you know, I look at what he's doing, right? Here's a guy who started out doing hip hop and now he's almost become this kind of bandana in the back pocket, you know, good time country, you know, rocker, and you know, he's totally you know, he's changed everything, you know.
Right. Right.
So that, you know, that's David Bowie is an example of someone who actually does that well. You know, he sampled a lot of different, you know, different styles. He still seems to earn respect for what he does and not feel like he's selling out. Although that dancing in the streets thing he did with Mick Jagger, that was pretty awful. But
right.
I listened to it, Rich. I listened to it.
Yeah, you know. Now, another band that you're really into, and I want to make sure I get this right, Agaloc?
Yeah, well, yeah,
okay.
That's perfect.
Oh, cool. All right, now, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you even sometimes write while listening to this band?
I only write listening to this band. I mean, when I'm listening to music and writing, it is only this band, Agaloc.
Wow. Okay,
yep.
So we'll talk about this band and what this band means to you.
I mean, these guys, it's this, you know, they're from the Pacific Northwest, and they play this. It's very unique. It's a kind of a combination of black metal, folk music, you know, psychedelia. It's a combination of influences, but it's this gorgeous, textured, atmospheric sound. You know, they do a really impressive job of kind of building up and ebbing, and you know, they create momentum very well. And on top of this stunning music, the singer John Holmes, his vocals are just. They're like the classic sinister black metal hiss, and to me it's like a beautiful contrast.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I was telling you when you told me you wanted to listen to this track, and I listened to it, you know, because I'd never heard them before. The way it starts out, it's really atmospheric, and it almost to me sounded like a band like, you know, Explosions in the Sky or Hammock,
yeah,
or something. And then this guy's voice, and it's just like, right. And I was like, numerous thoughts came into my mind. Like, one, how does that guy even have a voice at the end of a show? How does he even have a voice at the end of a song? It's like, wow, what a contrast. But you're right. It was really interesting, those two things. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, they're you know, typical black metal is, you know, it plays to more occult, you know, overtly occult influences, and, you know, people kind of say, well, it's satanic, some of it can be, but not all of it. But these guys are very tied into, you know, the earth and the environment, and, like, when they play live, you know, the singer John, he goes into the woods up, you know, they live around Portland, and he gets all these herbs and plants and ashes, and he comes back and he makes his own kind of, you know, stuff that you burn. He makes his own incense.
Wow.
And he sets up smudge pots all across the stage, very ritualistic, you know, before every show. Everyone's kind of placed in a certain way, and he lights each one in a certain order, and, you know, then he removes his ponytail and just starts playing. And it's this intense kind of, and they take wood stumps, stumps of wood from the, you know, their area. So everywhere they go, they take like the woods, like the earth with them. And,
nice.
It's a really cool show to see.
Nice. Now this particular track, is it called Bloodbirds? Is that the name of the track? And the name of the release is Our Fortress is Burning, or.
It's
what
there's like kind of like a suite at the end of you know, the album is Ashes Against the Grain, and
okay,
Our Fortress is Burning is like three parts.
Okay.
So it's part two.
Okay, great. So why don't we go ahead and listen to it? Our Fortress is Burning, part two, Bloodbirds from Agaloc.
We'll be right back.
That's one mighty powerful track, Joe. Thanks for turning me on to those guys.
No, man, you know, I just pass on to people, you know, hand over to me. That's an epic song.
Yeah, what are some factors? We're getting close to the end of our time, but I have a couple more questions I want to ask you. What are some factors that you think make or break bands and musicians in this day and age?
Risk. You know, that to me, that makes or break a band. In fact, whenever, you know, every album that I review, that's the one thing I look for, is what kind of risk are they taking? You know, it's either a risk, you know, are they taking a commercial risk? Are they doing something that might not get on the radio? Are they doing something that might alienate their fans? Like a band that has, you know, an appetite for risk is going to do something, you know, interesting. And that's the stuff that people remember. And, you know, and at the same time, I think you can't shock value is great and changing things is great. But, you know, the bands that have the tight musicianship and, let's be honest, you know, some good production, those are the ones who have a chance.
Right, right. Have you ever toured with a band before, playing correspondent, journalist?
I've done it a couple times. I toured with the Rugburns several times during the 90s, a folk punk band from San Diego, yeah. I learned a lot about life and myself on those trips.
Right. So if you could put a super group together, who would you want on vocals, guitar, bass, and drums?
Really? You going to do this to me?
Oh, come on. Give it a shot.
All right. I'm going to say vocals. I'm going to go with Robert Plant. He's just got that iconic metal voice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say for lead guitar, I'm going to say Slash. I'm going to say Keith Richards on rhythm guitar.
Nice.
I'm putting off drummer. I'm thinking about drummer in the back of my mind, but I'm going to think about a bass player first. I don't know, man. I guess you got to go with John Entwistle for bass.
Cool.
And the drummer, I'm torn, man. I'm torn. God. I mean, I love Keith Moon, but, you know, he was, he was kind of all over the place. And I like John Bonham. He kind of defined a whole genre.
Sure.
But I'm going to say Dave Lombardo from Slayer, just to shake it up. The guy's
good for
amazing.
You, man. Good for you. So we've reached the end of our time, Joe. Again, I want to say thank you so much for being on the show, man. It's been a true pleasure.
Man. Yeah, it's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, man. What's the best way for people to find out about you online?
I guess the best way, I got a website, joedaily.net, although I have to do a better job of keeping up with it. Honestly, if you go to the Weaklings, theweaklings.com is where I get a weekly, I either write or, publish someone else's column. And I'm very active on Instagram, JoeD_San Diego on Instagram.
Right. Yeah, and that's Weakling spelled Weeklings, correct?
Yeah, good clarification. Yeah. We don't want to give the other Weaklings if there is one.
Well, yeah. So, again, Joe, thank you. I also want to send a big thank you out to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at WeVoiceSing.com, YouTube, Facebook, and you can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be singer, songwriter, author, father, and so much more, Jeremy Toback. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.
Thanks, Rich. Oh,